Wisconsin, a critical battleground state.
The battleground state of Wisconsin.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session.
So let's talk about Wisconsin.
This is Swing State of the Union, a podcast all about Wisconsin and why it's so important to U.S. politics. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Sam Woods. Thank you so much for joining us. This season, we explore why the nonpartisan Wisconsin Supreme Court race feels so partisan and why it matters. A lot has happened since our last season. Joe Biden dropped out of the presidential race. Former Vice President Kamala Harris took over the top of the Democratic ticket, but she lost to Donald Trump, who won Wisconsin and is now the president. Democrat Tammy Baldwin won her race to remain one of Wisconsin's senators. But in Wisconsin, election season never ends. This April, the ideological balance of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is likely up for grabs. So this season, we're going to court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
It may be surprising to hear that a podcast about politics is exploring the courts. But in Wisconsin, where government is divided, the Supreme Court is where some of the biggest decisions about our laws are made. Issues like abortion, gerrymandering, unionization, they've all ended up in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In future episodes, we'll look at the partisan nature of court races, the role of money, and some of the biggest upcoming issues likely to be decided by the court. But in this episode, we step back and explain how the court system developed, why we elect justices, and how we judge judges.
Let's start with how courts work in Wisconsin and how the Supreme Court fits into the picture. To help navigate this system, we'll hear from Miriam Seifter, a professor of law at UW Law School and co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative.
The Wisconsin state court system has multiple layers, and it starts at the local level with municipal courts. And those are courts that most commonly handle things like traffic or parking matters. Then we have state trial courts, which are called circuit courts. And at the trial level, judges are doing a lot of fact-finding. They rule on things like evidence and credibility. In criminal cases, they are the ones who might impose a sentence relying on statutory standards and their case law. From the circuit courts, the next level up are the courts of appeals. That's where you would challenge an adverse circuit court decision. And then finally, we get to the state Supreme Court.
So let's say you get a speeding ticket and you need to go to court. You'll be going to one of Wisconsin's 219 municipal courts. The judge will decide what the penalty should be based on guidance from the state, and your case will end there. But let's say instead of getting a speeding ticket, you've been charged with a criminal offense. That means your case is likely headed to one of Wisconsin's 69 circuit courts, where it could be heard by both a judge and jury. These are what you might think of in a typical court scene you'd see on TV, where judges and juries hear from witnesses and weigh the different elements of a case to come to a decision.
Objection.
Withdrawn.
On the sole count of the indictment, murder in the second degree, how does the jury find?
We find the defendant not guilty.
If you don't like the outcome at the circuit court, you're headed to the next layer of Wisconsin courts, the Court of Appeals. There are just four appeals courts, representing the four districts of the state. In these, there aren't juries or witnesses, and judges aren't retrying cases. Instead, judges are simply reviewing decisions made by a lower court. And if you don't like the outcome at the Court of Appeals, then you're left with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Seifter notes that there are some exceptions to this process.
There are some cases that can be filed directly in the state Supreme Court, but most cases, the Supreme Court has discretion whether or not to accept after those cases have already been heard by a circuit court and a court of appeals.
And that's an important distinction. Unlike lower courts, the Supreme Court gets to choose which cases it hears.
The state Supreme Court often gets many hundreds of petitions for review and agrees to hear just a small fraction of those.
In recent years, the average number has been around 50 cases per session, but that can vary dramatically. Last year, the court only issued 14 decisions. According to experts, one reason is a deep partisan divide. Another reason they hear so few cases is because they have stricter criteria than lower courts.
Their focus, their criteria, tend to be on whether the question is novel, and whether answering the question will have a statewide impact or will resolve some recurring issue that is not clear around the state. So the state Supreme Court is trying to provide clarity to the state on the meaning of law, as opposed to something that's more common at the trial court level, deciding what happened between two parties or what the penalty or sentence should be. That's not what the state Supreme Court is focusing its limited bandwidth on.
It may be confusing why some cases end at the state Supreme Court instead of moving on to federal court or the U.S. Supreme Court. Seifter says federal courts have limited jurisdiction, and the cases they hear often raise an issue of federal law.
So some cases proceed in federal court because they meet those standards, and other cases proceed in state court. And sometimes you can have similar issues that end up percolating in both the state and federal courts, but under different legal provisions.
To better understand how this works, let's take two cases from Wisconsin that both dealt with partisan gerrymandering. That refers to the process of manipulating the boundaries of voting maps to favor one political party over another.
First, there was Gill v. Whitford. A group of Wisconsinites challenged the state's 2011 redistricting plan, claiming the maps violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution by gerrymandering the state's voting maps along partisan lines. Since this dealt with federal law in the U.S. Constitution, the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, in 2018, dismissed it for lack of standing. But that didn't end the fight over Wisconsin's maps. The next case, Clark versus Wisconsin Elections Commission, also focused on voting maps, but questioned their constitutionality based on a requirement laid out in Wisconsin's constitution that voting districts be contiguous, meaning they're fully connected.
State constitutions can't be less protective of people's rights than the U.S. Constitution because of the supremacy clause in the U.S. Constitution that makes federal law supreme. But state constitutions can be more protective of people's rights. And so sometimes people will go to state court to vindicate rights that the Supreme Court either has said they won't resolve, which is the case with partisan gerrymandering, or has just given some protection to, but litigants would be seeking more protection from a state court.
In this case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled in favor of redrawing the maps. It wasn't clear the case could go to federal court since the original complaint concerned the Wisconsin Constitution. After years of partisan struggle, the Republican-led legislature and Democratic Governor Tony Evers were able to pass new maps, and that was the end. Cases involving issues like gerrymandering or clarifying Wisconsin law are the kinds of cases that end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But you might not know that if you listen to campaign ads.
For example, advertisements might seek to portray a candidate as tough on crime or an opponent as soft on crime. But in the overwhelming majority of cases, a state Supreme Court justice is not determining what a criminal sentence should be.
Instead, the majority of cases are on civil matters, and most aren't the headline-making cases we might associate with the state Supreme Court.
These are often cases about what a provision of a Wisconsin statute means. A handful of those civil cases will be on hot-button issues like abortion or redistricting, but actually the court's day-to-day is much lower-profile matters, although of course they're matters that are very important to people throughout the state.
So that's essentially how the courts work. But one thing we didn't mention, why in Wisconsin state courts, including the Supreme Court, the judges are elected.
Hey, do you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution?
You may be familiar with Schoolhouse Rock and the idea that we have three branches of government, the legislative branch, the executive, and the judicial. The legislative branch includes representatives and senators, who write laws. The executive branch includes presidents and governors, who implement laws. And the judicial branch solves disagreements about laws. It might seem counterintuitive to elect judges at all. Ideally, they're there to be referees, experts in constitutional law that check the other branches when they overstep their authority.
But judicial elections stem from a question as old as the United States. Who should our judges be accountable to? Should they be accountable to the people, to politicians, to themselves? When the U.S. Constitution was written in the late 1700s, the framers generally believed that judges should be separate from the general public. And as a result, to this day, we do not elect federal judges. They are appointed for life by the president and confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
But individual states have always been allowed to choose how they select judges in their state courts. By the time Wisconsin wrote its constitution in 1848, states were more comfortable with the idea of judges being accountable to the public via direct elections. Philip Rocco, political scientist and professor at Marquette University, explains how this shift in the idea of judicial accountability led to us electing our judges today.
By the time you get to the middle of the 19th century, you have a very different understanding about the relationship between voters and elected officials. And so if you look at in the journals of the first constitutional convention for the state of Wisconsin, one of the delegates, in talking about the importance of an elected judiciary, says that electing judges would fulfill what he said was a, quote, axiom of government in this country, that the people are the source of all political power, and to them should their officers and rules be responsible for the faithful discharge of their respective duties. And so that idea that judges aren't somehow separate from society and the political process by the middle of the 19th century was a really kind of important one. And I think you see it embedded in state constitutions, not just in Wisconsin, but in states across the country.
As Rocco alludes to, Wisconsin is not the only state to elect its Supreme Court justices. In total, more than half of the states elect justices, though there is variability within that group. In 14 states, including Wisconsin, judicial races are officially nonpartisan. With this patchwork of systems across the country, you might think that by now we'd be able to say whether it's better to appoint or elect judges.
But Chris Bonneau, professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh, explains how more than 150 years after Wisconsin wrote its constitution, this question of whether justices should be accountable to the people directly through elections or accountable to legislators who appoint them is still a matter of perspective.
In states where judges are appointed, they are less likely to strike down acts of the legislature and executive as unconstitutional. Not surprising. Right? They're appointing them, and so they're less likely to be active in terms of judicial review. There has also been research that has found that in elected states, judges, when they're up for election, are more punitive than in the years where they're not up for election. And so if you're facing an election, one of the easiest ways to attack somebody is being soft on crime. And so when you're up for election, you tend to be more punitive. Some will look at that and say, aha, see, judges are pandering to the public. They're changing their behavior. This is why elections are bad. You could also look at that and say, this judge knows that she's out of step with the public. And so in that way, elections help bring the judge back more in line with the public and the preferences of the state.
Bonneau says people have strong opinions about whether justices should be elected, often depending on what you've experienced where you live.
If I give talk on judicial elections in Wisconsin, nobody bats an eye. Because you all like judges, you know how it is, you're used to it, nothing. I gave a talk on campaigning in judicial elections in New Jersey about a decade ago, and the people were horrified. And I showed them some judicial ads, and they're like, how can people do this? But this is awful. This is the worst thing. So they hated it, but it's not their experience either. So it's hard to ask somebody if they prefer X over Y when they only ever have experience with one or the other.
What may seem horrifying to people in New Jersey is that these campaigns can look very similar to partisan campaigns for offices like president or governor. In the world of campaign ads, it's clear the three branches of government come from the same tree. Here's examples from previous Wisconsin Supreme Court elections.
Dan Kelly has never sentenced a single criminal to prison.
Not one.
That's a fact.
But extremist Jennifer Doro, as a private attorney, she got rich defending predators.
Janet Protasewicz is a Milwaukee County judge with a long history of letting dangerous criminals back into our streets.
As you heard, even though Wisconsin's judicial elections are officially nonpartisan, political parties still get involved. In future episodes, we'll dig into how campaign ads for judicial races rarely reflect the types of cases justices will actually rule on most of the time, and instead signify a candidate's partisan alignment.
The thing is, campaigning in a partisan manner may actually boost voter participation. While most of the cases coming before the state Supreme Court would not interest the average voter, cases related to abortion, gerrymandering, and union rights do. So it's understandable that voters want to know what the candidates think about these issues, even if they're not what justices are spending most of their time on. Bono explains how even though a justice's work is about interpreting the law, their preferences are still relevant to voters.
Just because they have preferences does not mean they're behaving the same as legislators, that they're just making naked policy preferences. They are constrained, right, by the law and the Constitution. But how you see the law and the Constitution, what those words that are written down means, is affected by your preferences.
If the original intent of Wisconsin's Constitution was to make the courts accountable to the public, increased voter participation should be an entirely positive result.
But in an era of political polarization, there are downsides. Here's Miriam Seifter again. She's a professor of law at the UW Law School. She explains how increased voter participation in judicial elections can be a double-edged sword.
If you look back a couple of decades ago, state court elections tended to be sleepy, low turnout affairs, and there are downsides to that compared to today. The sort of older, quieter model may not be great for accountability if it means that only insiders pay attention and vote. But it did mean that state court judges had less of a need to campaign in the way we think of today's sort of high dollar, high profile campaigns. It might have allowed them to maintain a profile that's more in keeping with the idea of a neutral, impartial, independent decision maker. You can contrast that era with the more recent era where judicial elections have come into the spotlight, both because of increasing recognition of the importance of state courts, and also because the U.S. Supreme Court has left some hot-button issues to state courts. Along with that spotlight comes a more typical style of campaign that resembles the campaigns you'd see for legislators or for governors. A lot of sound bites, a lot of advertising, and, you know, maybe themes or talking points that sound policy-oriented.
A campaign characterized by sound bites and policy positions might run against the idea of how courts should work. In the Schoolhouse Rock version of our three branches of government, the legislative branch makes the laws, the executive branch implements the law, and the judiciary interprets the law in a manner that is meant to be impartial.
But what is a judicial candidate to do when they want to appear impartial but also need to run a campaign in 2025? As Seifter explains, when qualified candidates see what judicial elections have become, they may simply choose to sit out.
One possibility is the rise of the more prominent judicial campaign may affect who wants to run for judge, who's willing to throw their hat in the ring and run that kind of very active statewide campaign. It might result in campaigns that have much less to do with what judges actually do every day. But I think in the end, all selection methods have their pros and cons.
There's no perfect system for selecting judges, and nonpartisan judicial elections like those in Wisconsin are just one method. After a short break, we'll explore what qualities make a good judge in a polarized political landscape.
If you're enjoying WUWM's Swing State of the Union, please share it with a friend. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
So how do voters weigh impartiality versus politics when judicial races are so polarized? Chad Oldfather has some thoughts. Oldfather is a professor of law at Marquette University Law School and the author of a new book called Judges, Judging, and Judgment: Character, Wisdom, and Humility in a Polarized World.
He joins us to talk about the qualities that make a good judge and how that meshes with the qualities of what makes a good candidate. So, Chad, let's start with what's at the core of this book. In your view, what are the qualities that make a good judge?
Sure. So I think that what's at the core of it, the book's called Judges, Judging, and Judgment, and it's good judgment, ultimately, that I think is at the core of it. I think it's the case that everyone in their personal lives knows people who they regard as having good judgment and knows people whose judgment they wouldn't trust at all. And those things are loosely, if at all, correlated with things like raw intelligence or, you know, possession of certain expert or abstract knowledge, political views, and so forth, right? And so the idea is that I think, even though we can't do it precisely, we can identify at least certain components of what makes someone have good judgment. Being dispassionate, I think, is a big part of that. So too is intellectual humility, right? The idea that I might be wrong and I should always be asking myself, what if I'm wrong about this? I was quite struck. I saw the movie Conclave recently, and there's that speech that's kind of a key moment in the film where the cardinal who's leading the conclave opens it by saying, you know, I've come to believe that the greatest sin is certainty. And that really resonates with the idea that I'm pitching in this book, that we all ought to be a little less sure of ourselves, and we live in a world in which there's a lot of people who are very sure of themselves, and that frightens me.
There's a word that you used in that I find interesting, this idea of being dispassionate, because I think especially as we look at elected leaders, the people who we tend to be attracted to are these often firebrand kind of personalities. And yet, to be dispassionate is quite the opposite. Why do you think this is key to being a good judge?
I think it's just what the judicial role calls for, right? That if I'm a judge, particularly a judge whose job involves, to some greater or lesser degree, making law that is supposed to apply going forward, I have to be able to take myself outside the specific facts that are presented and look down the road and ask, how's this case going to matter in the next case and the one after that in situations where the shoe's on the other foot and it might be my side, if I have a side, that is asking for what, in this case, the other side's asking for. And think about, well, what, you know, what's the right answer? What's the fair answer? What's the best answer? You know, you're never going to fully escape the influence of things like politics and ideology. I think law, you know, sort of floats in a sea of politics and norms and customs and all these sorts of things. So you can't get away from it entirely. But I think that that doesn't mean you have to give into it completely. And so, you know, recognizing that, yeah, I might really want party A to win in this case as a product of my ideological preferences, but is that really the right answer? And, you know, it's really recognizing that under the rule of law, one of the core ideas is my team's not always going to win. That's how law is supposed to work. You know, it doesn't seem like that big of an ask, but on the other hand, you look around sometimes and you think, apparently it is a pretty big ask.
When you look at these qualities that make for a good judge, how does that square with the qualities that we think of making a good candidate? Are those two in opposition to one another, or do they – how do you look at that?
Sure. There's certainly a tension, I think, there in the sense that if one is looking to appeal to the electorate generally – you're absolutely correct in suggesting that people seem to be drawn to those who can confidently state their beliefs. You know, so I think changing the culture's view on this is an awfully big ask. Changing the profession's view, the legal profession's view, I think is less of an ask. And I think that's the place to start, that we within the legal profession really need to not allow ourselves to be polarized in the same ways and to the same extent that the world is polarized, and to try to converge around like certain norms, certain things that this is how judges should be. And if we as a profession and we in legal education can cultivate those values, then we'll produce lawyers who will become judicial candidates who will manifest those values. We will praise judges who exhibit those values, even if we don't agree with how they've applied them in a given case, and we'll criticize judges who don't. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think it's still a heavy-ish lift, but I'd like to think it's a real lift, a doable one.
This seems to speak to this larger trend of what I believe you describe as an erosion of norms in the judiciary. I'm interested to know what the norms are that have been eroded, essentially. What are the norms that you're talking about?
I think some of the norms are, and you know, I'll point to the Wisconsin Supreme Court as a place that exhibits this, right? It has become routine in some of the recent cases for the justices to openly accuse one another of being partisan in their opinions. And, you know, one of the norms is a norm of engaging in good faith and of taking my colleagues to be engaging in good faith. It would take a little bit to unpack specifically all of what goes on underneath that and what that means exactly, but that's one of them, right? I need to understand, I think, if I'm a judge or justice on a multi-member court, that I'm doing the best I can to get this right, and so is everybody else. And if we lose that trust, then all sorts of associated norms of how we interact with one another and our willingness to try to understand one another's position, those are going to fall away. If I don't think you're acting in good faith, I'm not going to be inclined to think about what you're saying, why you might be saying it, whether it makes sense, whether I might be wrong to think otherwise. I'll just dismiss what you have to say. That's not how it's supposed to work. That's not how it works well.
So given that Wisconsin's state Supreme Court justices are elected, would you recommend that we think of justices as politicians, given that they are elected and are accountable to the public every 10 years, you know, through the electoral process? Is it just easier to think of them as politicians, or is that it's a little more complicated?
Well, practically speaking, I mean, the answer is, you know, in terms of how the world works is one thing, and how I think the world should work is an entirely different thing. So how the world works is, yeah, that's where we're at. It is nonpartisan in name only. And we all understand these races to be proxy battles in the larger political wars taking place in the state. In my ideal world, right, where we care about judicial character and good judgment, we wouldn't be focused on that at all. Right, the campaigns would be about demonstrating, here's why I exemplify the qualities that a judge ought to have, and you should select me. That's tough, right? Because that doesn't sell as easily as partisan rhetoric does. So how we get to that world, I don't know, but that's the world I'd like to live in.
Chad Oldfather is a professor of law at Marquette University Law School and the author of Judges, Judging, and Judgment: Character, Wisdom, and Humility in a Polarized World.
To recap, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decides on a litany of cases affecting state law. Theoretically, we elect justices in Wisconsin to keep them accountable to the public, but those elections can influence how justices rule and the types of people who choose to run for the bench.
This season on Swing State of the Union, we'll examine how the court has developed over the past 30 years. We'll look at a watershed moment in Wisconsin, Act 10, and how the state's next Supreme Court justice could decide its future. We'll explore how corporate interests and well-funded donors have caused the state Supreme Court races to become the most expensive in U.S. history. And we'll learn about the candidates in this April's election, what they have to offer, and how their ideological beliefs could reshape Wisconsin for the next decade.
But next week, we'll explore how judicial races became entrenched in partisan politics.
And that's why I don't like liberal and conservative, because the minute you use those terms, everybody thinks, well, we know where you're going on abortion. We know where you're going now on Act 10 in Wisconsin. You know where you're going if the map issue comes up again. And you can go down the whole list. And it's as though we have super legislators sitting in those seats. At least that's the perception of the public.
Partisan Judgment. Next time on Swing State of the Union. I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. Swing State of the Union is produced by WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, a part of the NPR network. Please subscribe to the Swing State of the Union podcast wherever you like to listen.